Well, this week we are going to complete our nearly 5-year long journey through the Torah. Joshua is often called the sixth book of the Torah because Joshua tells us of the fulfillment of the Torah in the sense that it completes the journey of the Israelites from Egypt into the promised land. If the Bible stopped at the end of Deuteronomy, then we would have Israel prepare to enter, stand at the border waiting for the Lord's signal to come into the place of rest that he's readied for them. But the goal of the Exodus wasn't really the journey itself. The goal lay at the end of the journey, the actual possession of the land, and that's what you get into when you get into the book of Joshua. Well, we left off last time with Deuteronomy 33:9, Moses' blessing upon the priestly tribe of Levi. And I ended with something that I want to take just a moment to review and to comment upon, and it is the words of chapter 33, verse 9, in light of its counterpart in the New Testament, the Brit Hadashah, Luke 14:25. Deuteronomy 33:9 says this, of his father and mother, speaking to the Levites, he said, I don't know them. He didn't acknowledge his brothers or children, for he observed your word and he kept your covenant. This is referring back to the tragedy of Exodus 32, when Moses was returning from the summit of Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments in his arms, only to find all of Israel making merry and worshiping a golden calf that Aaron, the soon-to-be high priest of Israel, had fashioned for the people because they pressured him into doing it. Moses pronounced that God would destroy all those who stayed in allegiance to that false god, and then said that all who stood with Jehovah should come and stand with him. Aaron's sons, and the bulk of the tribe of Levi rushed to Moses' side, at least partially because Moses was a Levite. So this was just tribal loyalty for the most part. On the other hand, those who ran to Moses believed Moses' words that this was the point of decision. This was the moment that the people would be separated into those who were for God versus those who united themselves with another and a different God. It then became the unpleasant task of those loyal to the Lord Almighty to put to the sword the thousands of rebellious Hebrews who refused to turn away from their idolatry. And among those who would refuse and thus became targets were the very mothers and fathers and children of some of those Levites who gathered together with Moses. I mean, can you imagine the torment of those who thrust their swords and daggers into the hearts of their own parents, or in some cases of their own sons and daughters? Yet despite this pitiful, this awful duty of those in allegiance to Jehovah, it was not of their own minds, it was at God's order that they do it. They did not of themselves want to do it, nor did they feel any animosity, let alone hatred, towards those family members. It was a matter of obedience, and it was God's typical way, really, of meting out justice upon human beings. He regularly uses human beings to bring his justice to fruition. So it's in this backdrop that we have Yeshua's disturbing words from Luke 14 that have been so often misconstrued by Messiah's own disciples. There in Luke 14, verse 25, Yeshua says this to some Jews who were considering following him. Large crowds were traveling along with Yeshua, and turning, he said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his mother, father, wife, children, brothers and sisters, yes, his own life besides, he can't be my disciple. Although Yeshua was not suggesting that new disciples kill their relatives, nor to hate them in the common sense of the word hate today, it does mean that these potential disciples should disregard those relatives if they stand in the way of turning their lives over to Messiah. The message is that if your family makes you choose between a relationship with Christ and one with them, you must accept him and reject them. What an awful choice. The Hebrew sense of what is commonly translated in English as hate means to reject, means to have no regard for, as opposed to our modern sense of the word hate, which is to have this most intense level of dislike and disdain that's possible within a range of human emotions. So Jesus is not telling his would-be disciples that they're to go and develop an almost sociopathic animosity for their relatives. He's telling them that they must show no regard for the wishes of those close family members if they insist that the potential disciple is not to give loyalty to Yeshua as Lord and Savior. Often this verse in Luke is held up wrongly against the commandment to honor your father and your mother. That is, Yeshua spoke of a new commandment that abolished the commandment to honor your father and your mother. I know personally of cases, others have spoken to me about cases, where a young man or a woman has decided that if she or he wanted to enter into Christian ministry and the parents have forbidden it, then he or she goes ahead, does it anyway, and this is considered as a tension between the Torah commandment of honoring your father and mother and Christ's command to hate your father and your mother. While this doesn't necessarily answer the question of just what that young person ought to do in any of those given circumstances, the point is that Jesus' statement in Luke is not in contrast to the Torah commandment to honor your father and your mother. It's in comparison to what happened at the golden calf incident at the foot of Mount Sinai. And by the way, don't ever think that what was required of God's loyalists out in the wilderness is a thing of the past that you and I may not be confronted with, because at the Battle of Armageddon, a line will be drawn. And those allied to Jehovah will be on one side, and those against will be on the other, and there will be no middle ground. There'll be no peace treaties. And just as at one point it was all the Israelites who joined together in idolatry to the golden calf, but at the mediator's call, Moses' call, some realized what they were doing. And they repented, and they stood again with God. So it is with every human being who is a believer. Every one of us was born opposed to God, putting us in a similar position to those Israelites who worshiped the golden calf. And we had to, at some point, make a conscious decision to accept God's call to leave the old way with all of its loyalties, and instead and come and stand with him. And as the book of Revelation makes it brutally clear, it will be our tragic duty as those who stand with Messiah to follow his orders, to join him in holy war, and as holy warriors to go against and kill all those who are still opposed to God. And that will in some cases undoubtedly include family members, just like it did for the Levites. So if you've never found an urgency within yourself to bring the good news to your family members, you might want to consider that in the not too distant future, you may be standing before them, sword in hand, with no choice but to be the one who acts as God's agent to end their existence and to send their dark souls into everlasting fire. This is the human condition from which God is in the process of saving us. This is the devastating consequence of sin. Therefore, as a result of what the Levites did in verse 9, they have been rewarded with the privileges of verse 10. They will be the instructors of the people of Israel in righteousness and in holiness, and they will serve the Lord directly by means of the various rituals set down in the law. So let's reread part of Deuteronomy chapter 33. We're going to read starting at verse 9 and go to the end. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, that starts on page 239. Of his father and mother, he said, I don't know them. He didn't acknowledge his brothers or children, for he observed your word and he kept your covenant. They will teach Jacob your rulings, Israel your Torah. They will set incense before you and whole burnt offerings on your altar. Adonai bless his possessions. Accept the work he does, but crush his enemies hip and thigh. May those who hate him rise no more. And of Benjamin, he said, Adonai's beloved lives securely. He protects him day after day. He lives between his shoulders. Of Joseph, he said, may Adonai bless his land with the best from the sky for the dew and for what comes from the deep beneath, with the best of what the sun makes grow, with the best of what comes up each month, with the best from the mountains of old, with the best from the eternal hills, with the best from the earth and all that fills it, and in the favor of him who lived in the burning bush. May blessing come on the head of Joseph, on the brow of the prince among his brothers. His firstborn bull, glory is his. His horns are those of a wild ox. And with them he will gore the peoples, all of them, to the ends of the earth. These are the myriads of Ephraim. These are the thousands of Manasseh. And of Zebulun, he said, rejoice, Zebulun, as you go forth, and you, Issachar, in your tents. They will summon peoples to the mountain, and there offer righteous sacrifices. For they will draw from the abundance of the seas and from the hidden treasures of the sand. And of Gad, he said, blessed is he who makes Gad so large. He lies there like a lion, tearing arm and scalp. He chose the best for himself when the princely portion was assigned. When the leaders of Israel came, he carried out God's justice and his rulings concerning Israel. Of Dan, he said, Dan's a lion cub leaping forth from Bashan. Of Naphtali, he said, you Naphtali, satisfied with favor and full blessing from Adonai, take possession of the sea and of the south. Of Asher, he said, may Asher be most blessed of sons. May he be the favorite among his brothers and bathe his feet in oil. May your bolts be of iron and bronze and your strength last as long as you live. Yeshurun, there is no one like God, riding through the heavens to help you, riding on the clouds of his majesty. The God of old is a dwelling place, with everlasting arms beneath. He expelled the enemy before you, and he said, destroy. So Israel lives in security. The fountain of Jacob is alone in a land of grain and new wine, where the skies drip with dew. Oh, happy are you, Israel. Who's like you? A people saved by Adonai, your defender helping you, your sword of triumph. Your enemies will cringe before you, but you will trample down their high places. The next tribe to receive Moses' blessing was Benjamin. Now, Benjamin will occupy a small territory as sort of a buffer zone between the two most powerful tribes, Ephraim and Judah. In fact, Jerusalem and the Holy Temple would be built at the southern border of Benjamin's allotted territory. I see in the Apostle Paul a kind of prophetic spiritual illustration of Benjamin's geographical and political position, because Paul was a Benjamite. And he was assigned to interface with who? Gentiles. He was to be a buffer between the Jews of Judah and Gentiles. Verse 12 says, Benjamin is Adonai's beloved. In other words, Benjamin was looked upon with special favor and that the Lord would rest beside Benjamin. I think this is a direct reference to the wilderness tabernacle that would rest for a long time in Benjamin's territory. And then later on, the temple would be built in Benjamite Jerusalem. Now, verse 13 deals with Joseph, or better put, more the intent, the Joseph tribes. And the primary attributes of the Joseph tribes, who are represented by Ephraim and Manasseh, are fruitfulness and increase. This fruitfulness is even expressed within the meanings of the name Yosef, which means may he increase, and Ephraim, which means God's made me fertile. And in that era, the number one requirement for fruitfulness was rain, water. No rain, no water meant no crops, no pasture land, which is the meaning of the statement about dew from the sky. In the complete Jewish Bible, we see the sixfold use of the word best for what will come to the Joseph tribes. The Hebrew word, though, is meged, and probably a better word to translate it is bounty or abundance. The bounty from the deep is referring to springs and fountains from underground water sources. The abundance of sun is needed for crops. And in Israel, there's so much sun that they can generally produce four crops a year. Since months and seasons were measured by the moons and their phases, this mention of the bounty of the moon is, as in all previous references to that, it's got to do with agriculture. The bounty of the mountains and hills were trees, wood, limestone, precious metals, various kinds of food. And then it is said that all this fruitfulness is to be on the head of Joseph, who is the prince among his brothers. Now, I want to remind you, because unless and until we understand the position of Joseph and his representative tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, and the position of Judah, then we can misunderstand much prophecy and many New Testament passages. Joseph received only half of the firstborn blessing from his father Jacob. The other half of that firstborn blessing went to Judah. The traditional Hebrew firstborn blessing always consisted of two parts. One part was the transference of power and authority over to the tribe or nation, to that firstborn son. The other part was the giving of more material wealth to the firstborn than to the rest of the inheritors. This latter part was called the double portion blessing, because in general, the firstborn received twice as much, or just more, than any of his other siblings. And in a very unusual act that violated Middle Eastern custom, Jacob divided that firstborn blessing, and he gave authority, the power of authority, over to the nation of Judah, and the double portion blessing of wealth and abundance he gave to Joseph. Or better yet, the double portion blessing was assigned to Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who had been elevated into a status on par with Jacob's sons instead of their natural position as Jacob's grandchildren. But then we get this strange epithet about the Joseph tribes in verse 17 that says that he is like a firstling bull in his majesty, and that he has horns like a wild ox. See, a firstling bull is one of the highest sacrifices that can be offered at the tabernacle, second only to a mature 3-year-old or older bull. And bulls always denote great strength. A wild ox goring its enemies is symbolic of a strong warrior that's mighty in battle. So we go from the Joseph tribes being fruitful to their also being very great in numbers, possessing a great powerful army, and being good warriors. Then the relative proportions of the Joseph tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, are spoken of in prophetic terms. Ephraim will consist of myriads, tens of thousands. Manasseh will consist of thousands. This is proven to be accurate. Ephraim eventually dominated the northern regions of Israel, with nine other northern tribes, including his brother tribe Manasseh, coming under its dominance. They also eventually extended their reach to the ends of the earth, but in a very ironic way. They were conquered by the Assyrians and forcibly scattered throughout the vast Asian continent. The bulk of the people of the ten tribes that were scattered quickly became Gentiles, as they mixed so thoroughly with the many Gentile races of Asia that they lost their Hebrew identity. This was prophesied, by the way, in Hosea and in Isaiah, and in the book of Hosea, God said that those 10 tribes would become what? A non-people, a lo ami to him. However, as we have only recently discovered, a representative remnant of each and every one of those supposedly 10 lost and extinct Hebrew tribes has been found intact, each with a strong identity to its ancient Israelite tribal name and heritage. Not surprisingly, one of the largest of those discovered lost tribes is Manasseh, and many of them are making Aliyah to Israel. And as a matter of fact, the last time I was in Israel, my wife and I were walking down the international terminal, and there's a glass barrier between those going to the terminal and those coming from the terminal, and we heard singing and saw a huge procession of Manasseh coming in to the other side, led by rabbis with tambourines and joy and flags. We were watching the 10 lost tribes returning to Israel. Now, Zebulun is the next tribe. Does that not send a chill on your spine? It ought to. This is indicative of being in the end times, folks. Zebulun is the next tribe that's discussed. Verse 18 tells us of Zebulun to rejoice in their journeys. Zebulun has always been associated with trade merchants. Issachar is likewise told to rejoice in their tents. And tents were the permanent homes for herders because they were mobile, or the first mobile homes. And Issachar has always been associated with herding and ranching. And a strong tradition about Issachar and Zebulun is also echoed in verse 19. They form a solid partnership and allegiance with one another that brought prosperity to both of them. Now, Gad receives his blessings in verse 20. Enlarging Gad means to increase the population. Now, Gad was one of three tribes that all or in part decided to accept territory outside of the promised land as their portion. Gad received perhaps the most outstanding pasture and croplands of any of the tribes. Gad was also known for having highly trained troops, although not necessarily the largest army. Therefore, the symbolism of fierce warriors is used, as the verse said, Gad lies there like a lion ready to attack. Verse 21 brings up this matter of Gad choosing to stay outside the promised land, when it says he chose the best for himself. The best means the prime, the excellent, in this case, land. Now, Dan, like Gad, is said to have lion-like strength and battle ability. The tribe of Dan was originally assigned lowlands that abutted the infamous Philistines' territory, and later, mainly as a result of their being harassed by those Philistines, they migrated northward to the farthest reaches of Canaan. There they conquered this cult city of Laish, changed its name to Dan, and fell away from God and into terrible idolatry. Naphtali was blessed with very fertile territory that was located on the west shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was beautifully watered. The land was rich, the climate temperate, having the advantage of the bounty of the sea. Plus, the fertile land gave Naphtali an almost idyllic location, as anyone who's traveled in that area of Israel knows. It's just gorgeous up there. It's my favorite spot, as a matter of fact, in all of Israel. I love the Galilee region. They were also given the privilege of being the territory where Messiah would be raised in the town of Nazareth. Now, Asher is also blessed with fertility because he settled in the upper Galilee region between Naphtali and the Mediterranean Sea. And the phrase says that Asher was the favorite of the brothers. Now, this is poorly translated. Okay. It means the most favored among the brothers in the sense that Asher was greatly blessed. Saying that Asher would dip his foot in oil, listen, is not referring to petroleum. They're not going to discover oil there. Okay. It means olive oil. That's all. Whenever you read that term in the Bible, some people have used it to say, oh, they're going to discover vast quantities of oil. No, it's always referring to olive oil, not petroleum. Dipping his foot in oil is thought to mean that there was a great abundance of olive oil in his territory. Now, since Asher occupied the area that a major trade route and military highway crossed, they had the benefit and the danger that came because of it. Therefore, Moses blesses Asher with the wisdom and the strength to take advantage of the economic situation and to guard against foreign armies by building stout defenses. Now, beginning in verse 26, having blessed each tribe individually, Moses concludes by celebrating the good fortune of Israel as a whole congregation to be under the watchful eye of their God, Jehovah. But before we go there, I wonder if anybody's noticed that not every tribe has been mentioned in this blessing. One has been skipped. Simeon. Let's talk about that for a minute. Simeon, or better, Shimon and Levi, were the two sons of Jacob who received what was essentially curses instead of blessings at Jacob's, their father Jacob's, deathbed blessing of his children. Some years later, Levi showed great merit at the golden calf incident, and so he wound up being selected as the Lord's designated priests, despite Jacob's curse on them that would manifest itself in other ways. But what of Simeon? What of Shimon? Simeon was cursed along with Levi because together the two had conspired. Remember the story? They had conspired to attack the helpless residents of Shechem in ages past for family revenge. History proves that Simeon wound up as a very small, non-influential tribe and found itself completely surrounded by Judah's territory, so it was pretty well doomed from the get-go. Not terribly long after the tribes of Israel settled in Canaan, the tribe of Simeon was absorbed, for the most part, by Judah. And they vanished as a separate territory and, generally speaking, as a separate self-governing tribe. However, as was usual for tribal societies, the memory of the family, the bloodline of Simeon, continued on. And so many Hebrews identified themselves as having that particular tribal heritage, even though it no longer functioned as a tribal unit. Now, here's what I find interesting. We have Moses' last words in Deuteronomy 33 as spoken to the 12 tribes, but one of the tribes, Simeon, has been cursed, so it's left out, leaving just 11. It has always been noticed that just as there were 12 original tribes of Israel, so there were 12 original disciples of Jesus. One of these disciples was an, pretty infamous guy named Judas Iscariot. There's some argument over what Iscariot means. Some say it's referring to a geographical region called Creote. Others say it's a play on the word Sicari. Now recall who Judas was. He was a fundamentalist militant who was trying to foment another Jewish rebellion against the Jews' oppressor, Rome. Judas' actions showed just how radical he was when he turned over his master, Yeshua, to the authorities. When he figured out this man is not going to be the deliverer of Israel that Judas had hoped for, because Jesus was simply not a military leader with insurrection on his mind. Judas was a zealot. Zealot was the name of a Jewish political party. They might be compared with Zionists today, people who feel that only Jews should occupy and govern the Holy Lands. One faction of the zealot party then was called the Sicarii. These men were out-and-out assassins who tried to enforce their particular brand of Judaism and patriotism on everybody else by using intimidation, murder. Everything considered, I tend to come down on the side of Iscariot as simply being a wordplay of the term Sicarii, and Judas likely being known as a Sicarii radical, because it just fits like a glove. Where did Judas come from? Who was his family? Well, the other disciples were all Galileans, but almost nothing is known about Judas. But we do find a very tantalizing piece of information about him in John, the 13th chapter, verse 26. Yeshua answered, "It's the one to whom I give this piece of matzah after I dip it in the dish." So he dipped the piece of matzah and he gave it to Yehuda ben Shimon, Judas, son of Simeon, from Creote. Now what makes this tantalizing is that here we have him called Judas, the son of Simon, or Simeon, or Shimon. Here's the thing. Simon, Shimon, Simeon, as in the tribe of Simeon, they're all the same Hebrew name, just transliterated into various Hebrew spellings, or rather various variant English spellings. It was the norm in the Bible era to identify a person by his tribe. So a Hebrew with the family name of Shimon would usually be expected to be attached by heritage to the tribe of Shimon, Simeon. You wouldn't, for example, name a person from Levi if they were from the tribe of Ephraim, or Manasseh if they were from Dan. So almost certainly, Judas was from the tribe of Simeon, long ago absorbed into the Judah tribe, but still remembering his family heritage by retaining the family name, Simeon. Okay, now with that background, I want you to watch this. Moses was giving his final words to the 12 tribes just hours before his death, hours. And in his final words, words that amount to a series of individual prophetic blessings over the tribes, 12 tribes, Moses mysteriously leaves out Simeon. Why? Because they'd been given a cursed prophetic future by Jacob. So the blessing of Moses was only on 11 of the 12. Now we fast forward 13 centuries to the time of Yeshua. And the night before he is to die, Jesus is giving his final words to his disciples by means of offering blessings at the Passover table, what we did last night. All 12 disciples are there, whoops, except for one who's not there. 11 of the 12 are there. Who's that 12th one? Judas. He disappears. He goes and fetches a temple guard. He leads them to Yeshua. They arrest him, turn him over to the Romans to be tried and executed. Judas, who's from the tribe of Simeon, as his name implies, is cursed by his act. He commits suicide. Now there's 11 disciples. Do you see the correlation here? It's amazing. Knowing the power of God patterns, it's difficult for me not to see the prophetic pattern established in the blessing of Moses over the 12 tribes, which turned out to be blessing for 11, curse for one, into the blessings of Messiah Yeshua over the 11 disciples. The circumstances are eerily familiar. The fact that Moses and Jesus were blessing 12, essentially, is the same. That it was immediately before their death is the same. That one of the 12 was removed is the same. And the one who was removed is associated with the Simeon tribe, the cursed tribe. That's the same. Back to the blessings of Moses in Deuteronomy 33. Moses is now addressing all the tribes as a group, and he began his final words by acknowledging the greatness of the God of Israel, and he ends those words with the same message as at the beginning. He pleads with Israel, once again referred to as Yeshurun, meaning the upright one, to understand that it's pointless to ever fall into worshiping another god because none of them measures up to Yehovah. And among the things that Yehovah does for Israel from his heavenly throne is to help them in time of need, to be a refuge for them, and to support Israel, to be a foundation and underpinning for Israel. And since God is from everlasting to everlasting, he'll always be there for them. Now Moses reminds Israel, it was the Lord who drives out the enemy before them. It's the Lord who causes Israel to dwell in safety and security. It's the Lord who gives Israel abundant rain that brings about plentiful grain and wine. It's the Lord who delivered Israel from Egypt. It's the Lord who constantly watches over Israel, protects them against the known and the unknown dangers. And if they will be faithful to the Lord will make Israel's enemies cringe and fall on their faces before Israel. And Israel will put their foot on their enemy's back. This is a pretty standard image for that time. A victor pushes the vanquished to the ground. He places his foot on the upper back by the neck as an indication that the former enemy is now fully under the victor's control. Let's move on to the short chapter 34 of Deuteronomy to finish out our study. Page 241, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Chapter 34. Moshe ascended from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the summit of Pisgah across from Jericho. There Adonai showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, the land of Judah all the way to the sea beyond, the Negev and the plain, including the valley where Jericho, the city of date palms, is as far away as Zoar. And Adonai said to him, this is the land concerning which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to your descendants. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you will not cross over there. So Moses, the servant of Adonai, died there in the land of Moab, as Adonai said he would. He was buried in the valley across from Beit Peor in the land of Moab, but to this day no one knows where his grave is. Moses was 120 years old when he died, with eyes undimmed, vigor undiminished. The people of Israel mourned Moses on the plains of Moab for 30 days. After this, the days of crying and mourning for Moses ended. Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom. For Moses had laid his hands on him, and the people of Israel heeded him. They did what Adonai had ordered Moses. And since that time, there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom Adonai knew face to face. What signs and wonders Adonai sent him to perform in the land of Egypt upon Pharaoh, all his servants, and all his land, what might was in his hand. What great terror he evoked in the eyes of all Israel. Grandfather Moses, after blessing those he's cared for day and night for the past 40 years as God's right-hand man, after having a few hours, maybe a day or two, to bask in the glow of how far Israel has come and the tremendous opportunity that lay ahead of them, he now ascends Mount Nebo to die. Verse 1 says that Nebo is in the Pisgah mountain range, opposite Jericho. Nebo's on the east bank. Jericho's on the west bank of the Jordan River. And Jericho, by the way, is widely acknowledged, even by secular archaeologists, as the world's oldest discovered city. Now, from Mount Nebo, Moses was shown by God the promised land that Moses' people would inherit. The order of the tribes, territories called out here in Deuteronomy 34 is as if Moses turned his head to the right and then he swiveled it towards the left in a vast panorama. It's as though his eyes were sweeping from the northernmost part of the land back towards the west and then finally to the south. And says the Lord, this is the land I have sworn to your ancestors. Now, I've made a point of this before, but let me make it again as emphatically as I know how. The land of Canaan was the promised land for Israel, no other. There is no alternative place that the Lord has prepared for Israel. There is no alternative people who have a right to occupy that land. There is no option A or B. Over the centuries, and even within the last 100 years, there's been some serious efforts by powerful men and national leaders to establish a new Jewish homeland in Europe, in Africa, anywhere but in the place the Lord set apart for the Hebrews. From that day going on 70 years ago that the UN voted to allow the Jewish people to have a Jewish nation in their ancient homeland, the world's leaders have openly regretted it. And they never cease trying to reverse that reality. I have no intention of making a political statement, but it is obvious that the current and last several presidential administrations had and continue to have no interest in honoring the biblical holy lands for what they are, a holy place, like no other place on earth, that belongs only to God and is set aside for a specific people. It doesn't matter how many photos there are of these presidents bowing their heads, praying, or calling on the name of Jesus in public, or standing up and speaking of defending Israel and Israel's right to exist. The Israel they wish to defend is an Israel they wish to invent and define on their own terms. This is greatly offensive to our Lord. And we will all pay an enormous price sooner or later for this arrogance by our elected leaders as to push for a Palestinian state in the promised land, or to declare Islam should have the legitimate right to maintain a pagan shrine to a false god on the Temple Mount, and for our indifference to their decisions. Nations and empires have risen and fallen for underestimating or ignoring the Lord and trying to take from his hand what belongs to him alone, and he's jealous of it. Could Moses have seen with human eyes all the way from Dan in the north to Zebulun in the west to Judah in the south? Of course not. No mountain peak was sufficient height to allow that. But since the scriptures say that the Lord showed him the whole land, I suspect that God enabled Moses to see in a supernatural way a land that could not otherwise be viewed except from maybe outer space or a satellite. Now, tradition is that Moses died 6 months to the day after his brother Aaron, the high priest, died. It was in the month that would later be called Adar, which corresponds to late February, early March. The Lord himself buried Moses, and his actual burial place was therefore kept secret. Why would God do this? Undoubtedly so that a shrine would not be built, aggrandizing Moses, and so that the place would not become one where armies fought in the name of one religion or another, as men have been wont to do ever since there were armies. I think it's significant that despite the amazing record of Yeshua's ministry and passion on the cross, there is no definitive map of where his body was buried or entombed, actually, even for that short 3-day stay. The garden tomb that one visits in Jerusalem today is just a guess. There is absolutely no evidence that this was Yeshua's tomb, although no doubt it's very much like the tomb he was actually laid to rest in. And by the way, the people that, wonderful people that control that area, tell you exactly what I just told you. Now, how is it that such a widely witnessed and attested event would not record the precise location of that tomb? Because if it were certain, there'd be a shrine made there and people would worship the place instead of God. All you have to do, how many people here have been to Israel? Oh my, I'm with Stan Rosenthal. What's wrong with the rest of you? All you have to do is walk down a place called the Via Dolorosa over there. It's the traditional path that Jesus walked as he headed towards Calvary. You know what you see? Gaudy, overdone, gold-encrusted churches and shrines with statues, marble floors with locations marked where Jesus supposedly stood, knelt, or bled. That's all you see. Verse 7 tells us that Moses was 120 years old when he died. He was in good health and his eyesight intact. When we get back to Genesis, we're going to find that the Lord pronounced that 120 years was given as a lifespan for men. But we also find that many lived lives well beyond that age. And of course, many more, much shorter. 120 years is some type of idealized human lifespan in the Lord's eyes. So it's no coincidence that Moses lived precisely that long. Now, Moses would be mourned for the standard mourning period, which is 30 days. For that 30 days, Israel stayed at their camp in Moab, preparing to enter the Promised Land to be led by their new military and civil leader, Joshua. We are told that Joshua, son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom. Why? Because Moses had laid his hands upon him. This is a widely misconstrued verse. It sounds in plain English as though Moses somehow supernaturally put the spirit of wisdom to Joshua by ritually laying his hands on him. In fact, this is an idiomatic expression. It describes a common act involving the new and former leaders of a nation. The outgoing leader would lay his hands upon the incoming leader in a public ceremony as a gesture, as a physical confirmation of transferring authority over the nation. Nothing supernatural is actually hinted at in that process. Rather, it's made clear in the scriptures that God gives the spirit of wisdom to all leaders of Israel. So because Joshua became the leader of Israel, as indicated by Moses laying his hands on him, then God gave Joshua a spirit of wisdom in order to properly lead his people. Well, Moses was never equaled by another prophet until Yeshua of Nazareth 1,300 years later. Jews, other than for Messianics, would vehemently disagree with that statement I just made, of course. And the reason for this statement of verse 10 is to make it clear that as great and as venerated and as valid with the coming prophets like Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and others, they were not like Moses in status. Nothing they could ever say could override what Moses said. Nothing would be added to the scripture in the future by means of those words that God's prophets would utter that could override the principles and laws contained in Moses' words. And I want to tell you, church, if the prophets of God couldn't override Moses, neither can a pastor, a priest, a pope, a bishop, or a rabbi, or even a popular televangelist. Let me also tell you in complete confidence that neither did Yeshua's words override Moses' words. I don't even have to speculate on this, because that's exactly what Messiah said, and it was recorded. So I'm going to refer to you one last time before we complete the study of the Torah to Yeshua's own undisputed words, by the way, undisputed, of Matthew 5, 17 through 19. Don't think that I've come to abolish the Torah or the prophets. I've come not to abolish, but to complete. Indeed, I tell you that until heaven and earth passes away, not so much as a uterus stroke will pass from the Torah, not until everything that must happen has happened. So whoever disobeys the least of these commandments, and they teach others to do so, they're going to be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever obeys them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Jesus brackets the subject of whether he came to do something or anything to the books of the Torah and the prophets in this way. He says in these verses of Matthew that on the one hand, he did not come to do away with them in their entirety, and on the other, he didn't come to change even the tiniest letter of it. That's about as thorough and sweeping of a statement that a Jew could ever make on the subject. Not all of it, and not the tiniest piece of it. Now, Christ was indeed a greater prophet and a greater mediator than Moses. Yeshua was and remains and shall always be the ultimate prophet, the ultimate mediator, because he's also our redeemer. But even he was such absolute authority from Jehovah that he said, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." Said outright, he did not come to abolish, change, subtract from, or add, or even challenge the words of Moses. So in the coming weeks and months and perhaps years, as the Lord wills it, and we study together more and more of the Old Testament, we incorporate into our study the words of the New Testament. Just keep what I told you as a touchstone. Because to stick to the Torah is life. To deviate from it is death. This ends our study of the five books of Moses, the Torah.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.